Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. Episode 130 of CJ Evolution, that's Criminal Justice Evolution. This is a show for the criminal justice professional like you, hosted by me, another criminal justice professional. We talk about so many different topics in this podcast: leadership, mentorship, how things need to change, how you need to change to be a better criminal justice professional. Now, on the show recently, I had Michael Wood Jr. If you don't know who he is, he's a police scientist and national leader on activism for criminal justice reform. Now, it was a great interview with Michael. We don't agree on everything, but he does bring some interesting things to the table. So I hope you enjoy this part one of a part two series with Michael Wood Jr. Welcome back, everybody, to CJ Evolution. I have on the podcast Michael Wood. Michael, welcome, sir.
Well, thanks for having me. You know, I have this traditional thing where I usually mess up people's intros as like kind of like my trademark, and I totally didn't want to mess up your intro because you sounded so professional, and now I don't know what to do. We have to start off on a different note.
Well, I'll add an intro later on, like I told you. Mike, you know, I mean, I don't know if you want Michael or Mike. Does it matter? Or
I don't care.
Well, Mike, can you, for those of my listeners or the listeners out there who don't know who you are, can you give us your bio, sir?
Well, so I fundamentally believe, like philosophically, that we are all products of the environment and influences around us. So I don't think there's any other way to tell how I get to what we're going to talk about with police reform other than that story of who I am and where I come from. So I'll just start telling it, and then if whenever you want to interject, just jump in and we can sidetrack one another.
Go ahead, sir.
Okay, so I went into the Marine Corps at 17, and I had that whole, I'm going to save the world, I'm going to help people, I'm going to rise out of poverty to do good deeds in life, and I'm going to have fun while I'm doing it. So if you're going to do it in the Marine Corps. And if there's anything I think that the Marine Corps really instilled in me, it was this sense of professionalism, and that whoever, no matter what the problem was, it was only a matter of your effort and creativity in order to achieve that goal. You can do it. And they really instill that in you. So I took that into policing with me as soon as I left the Marine Corps after doing my 4 years. And I took that idea with me, and I tried to have this like race blind, I'm going to be this professional RoboCop, and I'm going to be perfect, and I'm going to execute justice without any biases and prejudices. And I ended up setting foot in Baltimore, where I grew up in the suburbs of, and that's where I was a police officer. Mm-hmm. And I very ironically ended up putting my first steps as a police officer were on the same concrete that were Freddie Gray's last steps. Mm-hmm. And so we have this kind of circle effect that goes around in what happened there. So I was an overachiever in the police department. I rose up through the ranks really quick. I was the youngest major case narcotic detective. And being in narcotics, watching these big cases unfold and seeing how people really were and getting intimate, I really felt that objectively, this mission in the drug war was harmful to police officers, and it was harmful to the community that I was in. And my actions there weren't going to be beneficial. I ended up getting promoted out of there, kind of like left that mentality out of me, and then ended up going in and commanding units and becoming a supervisor. So as I was a supervisor back in patrol, and a lot of cops that were detectives for a long time, you know this, you get isolated. Mm-hmm. Then you go back into patrol, and you're like, oh my gosh, this is what the police department is? I forgot. This is so inept. And so I go out there, and I'm 27. I'm 09, so I'm the shift commander on the Eastern District of Baltimore for people watching The Wire. And here I am, really essentially an overachieving punk kid who is now like in charge of an entire district. I am the king of that district.
Now, how many people in that district, Mike? How many officers were you in charge of?
So there would be anywhere from 30 to 40 on the street at a time.
And you were a sergeant, correct?
Right, I was a sergeant, so okay. But that doesn't mean anything. Just like in the Marine Corps, as soon as a corporal gets there, That means the sergeants get to screw off.
So you take command, Corporal.
So it doesn't change no matter where you go. And so I go in that unit, and then I start feeling like this heavy sense of responsibility because these officers, be it through no fault of their own, they're incredibly unprofessional. So I said about myself that I was going to create this guide, and I was going to document it, and I put it on Amazon, and I did the whole thing where the promotional things, you need a stack of books, and who knows where they're going to choose the questions out of them, who knows what they're going to be doing. And in Baltimore, what tended to happen is the people, the good old boy network, would select who they wanted to promote, and they kind of would feed them the clues and the information that we all kind of know goes on in policing. Well, I wanted to level that playing field for one, because I saw a lot of internal racism with the police department when it came to promotions. They actually had a big lawsuit in Baltimore that dealt with that. They had medical, they ended up like pushing officers out that were black more. They ended up giving them harsher punishments more. They got crappier units. Like, I was in the major case narcotics squad, and there was only one black guy in a city that's black. This doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. So I started to see those kind of things and wanted to level the playing field, make everybody able to do this. So I wrote a 518-page guide, which is like detailed, perfect professionalism, how to do everything. And this is what we should do. Everybody learned this. I set about to training other officers on my own time. And I ended up getting like close to 50% of the next promotional class was all people that I had trained. And that disrupted the power system a little too much, where they decided they were going to marginalize their little superstar sergeant who was overstepping his boundaries. So doing that, I ended up having a lot of time in the whole drive. I ended up getting my bachelor's degree and criminal justice. Mm-hmm. And that's when I really started looking. I'm like, okay, so what is wrong here? And like, my bachelor's in criminal justice doesn't lead me anywhere. I don't feel like I'm getting solutions and answers out of this. I feel like I'm looking at an ideology that doesn't have solid data behind it. Mm-hmm. So I go around, and I'm still trying to figure out how I get more professional. I'm looking around, and I think we clearly have a management issue here. It's not only shouldn't be in this high-ranking management position as a 27-year-old. We had a commissioner who was a CEO of the biggest wing of the city, a major corporation, and he had a GED. And it's like, we cannot. This is impossible. We are doing completely wrong. We have a management problem. So I started my master's in management and information technology on purpose with this pursuit that I was going to figure this out. So I ended up getting hurt at work, and they pushed me out on a line of duty injury. I think they wanted it that way. It was easy to get rid of me. It's a good pension. I shut my pie hole and I took it.
Yep.
So I went out after doing 11 years and really set myself that I'm going to do the science of this. I'm going to figure this out. What is wrong with our management issue? So what I ended up seeing is that the theories and science of business management will put this together. It started like bringing the pieces together for me, and that we have an input and output misalignment. We have shareholders and people who want police service and people who pay for police service, but none of those people are actually determining what the police do, which in any business sense of the world does not make any sense. This is like the customers of Wendy's are determining what is served at McDonald's. This makes no sense whatsoever from a fundamental management perspective. So I see that our metrics and our incentives are completely misaligned with what we should be encouraging officers to do. Mm-hmm. So like, for instance, I was incentivized the entire time to do arrests, and that's arrests, not convictions, which is a dramatically different thing that we would be measuring, in that when I was a sergeant, I felt like any mid-level manager should. You protect your people by giving those idiot bosses what they want. Mm-hmm. What those idiot bosses wanted was arrest stats. So I got them the arrest stats. I made sure my team was the leading in the city the entire time, no matter what, which incentivizes my officers, continually raises the bar on what average is. And then what I did in de facto was I created a quota system by misaligning my incentives towards the arrest that the bosses wanted.
Now, first of all, Mike, thank you for your service as a Marine. Thank you so much. And your service as a Baltimore police officer. Now, when you talk about, I want to kind of back up just a little bit, because you said that you were seeing a lot of unprofessionalism, you know, by the officers. Can you explain what you meant by that?
Well, I try not to get into this too much, because I try not to throw them under the bus a lot. But
well, you don't have to give, obviously.
I mean, I know. But from mere, like, ineptitude, like, they would go out and arrest a man who was on his porch drinking a beer, because technically he put his beer down on the sidewalk, and that would give you an arrest for drinking in city property, because the sidewalk was city property. I saw managers who had absolutely no idea how to handle basic issues with people, because from the very beginning, you're being judged. The kind of promotional system is okay, who's a good cop? Let's make them a manager. Well, those things don't align. Being a good cop has nothing to do with being a good manager, and being a good manager has nothing to do with being a good cop. Mm-hmm. So they just didn't have any of the skill set available. So when it came to things like how you were going to approach the 4th of July when it comes to a crime plan, what they would do is the same old things. You saturate the streets because somebody else before them did that. They run trains of cars, and they try to jack people up all day long and show a show of presence. Well, I mean, that's what you do every year, and you get the same results every year. What are you guys doing? This is completely inept in trying to move forward. They were doing a reporting on pen and paper, so they did a roll book with pencils on literal paper in the 21st century. And just complete not having control of what was going on or understanding what you were incentivized.
So was that just systemic throughout the department? Was there anybody in the department that said, hey, guys, you know, you don't have to go out there and arrest everybody. You know, we can engage in some community policing. We don't have to hammer everybody we come into contact with. I know you said it was stat-driven and stuff like that, but was there anybody in the department that said, hey, we should be doing things differently? You know, we should maybe go this route. And I know you were part of that. And where was there anybody else?
Well, a lot of those people ended up being ostracized and not getting what command wanted. So they ended up being the supervisors that were troublemakers. Of course, I ended up having a lieutenant that was very much that way, who, of course, influenced me, that he was obsessed with reading all the books, doing all the training on his own time, and trying to treat people in a different manner. And that certainly rubbed off on me without question. So it's not like we were alone. And when I had to do that guide, we all recognized that. So that kind of comes back. It's actually a pivotal moment where that lieutenant, he wanted to start training everybody and kind of giving them knowledge that was on the shift. And he said that he was going to ask them questions. And I kind of was just messing with them and kind of giggled at them that they wouldn't know anything. And he said his first question he wanted to ask them was, what constitutes a legal arrest? And I was like, they don't even know that, man. There's no way they know the legal definition of an arrest. Mm-hmm. They kind of only know the concept of philosophically what it is. They don't understand philosophically what it is. And so he goes out and asks them, and of course the whole shift, nobody has any idea. And I came back in gloating and being an arrogant little punk like I was, and probably still am to some extent. And I was laughing about it, telling you, ha, you didn't know anything, told you I'm right, blah, blah, blah. And then it kind of sat there in silence and was like, oh. This is our problem, and we just identified a problem on our shift with lack of knowledge, and we're the bosses, so this means this is on us. Mm-hmm. And they did a lot of covering for me in order to write that book, which ended up taking 2 years of my life of like constant work and figuring out how to do that.
Interesting. Now, I mean, there are obviously, Mike, we talked about this a little bit off the air, obviously a lot of problems in law enforcement. Do you think that the problems within law enforcement and corruption, I'm the first to say there is corruption within law enforcement. I don't think it's huge. I think there is a level of corruption. Maybe you and I disagree on that. Do you think it's systemic? Do you think it's just across the board? Do you think it's in every department? Or is it just kind of what you saw just within the department you worked at, and you kind of got a different view of just what you saw? Does that make sense? Or do you think it's all across the board?
It totally makes sense what you're saying. I think that it's fundamentally across the board, and only individuals that are great and stand up on their own can possibly mitigate it. And my problem with that, well, we can get into why I think that way, but the fundamental problem with that is that we are relying on great individuals, and I'm not very interested in relying on great individuals. Mm-hmm. I'm more interested in a system that only allows or encourages great individuals.
Okay.
And don't really want to select who they are.
Because I've seen... Oh, go ahead. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, so as I went through my things, like when I say it's systemic, this is part of the reason. So like crime stats and what we've based all of our data on, they're a measure of police action and not citizen action. And that was mind-blowing to me when I tied up what that information actually is. When we have an arrest stat and we say that 16 to 24-year-old black males are most likely to commit a crime, that is completely untrue. The stat is that 16 to 24-year-old black males are most likely to be arrested and charged with a crime, which is an entirely different thing.
But why do you think that is? Is
okay, that's what happened. So that's where I am. That's where I am in my thinking at that time. I'm saying, why is this? I can't figure this out at the time. So what I wanted to do then is I began my PhD program in management and education to dig further into why that is and like, why is this? And really what I was learning and trying to come to grips with was that I wasn't racist. I was not a racist officer, but something was pushing me and my actions were objectively racist. I went back and we looked at my records. I locked up 458 people in just those few years that I was on the street, 5 or 6 years. I mean, before becoming a supervisor, once you're a supervisor.
Mm-hmm. you don't do anything when you're a supervisor.
That's not going to happen. So in that short amount of time, and like 96% of them were black males. And that's just not, I know that when you're digging in the literature, you know that white people and black people use just the same rates, and they deal them at the same rates. If nothing, white people actually do it slightly more, which would be a logical result of a system that ends up putting a little more resources into its colonial roots. So that makes total sense that white people have more resources. That's one reason why black drug dealers get locked up more, is they don't have resources to do good drug dealing. So I saw that in reality happening in front of me and wondering, so here's the thing. If I'm not racist, but my actions were objectively racist, then what I can do is I can make a system where it doesn't even matter if the cops are racist. I can set up incentivizations and systems in place, which means all cops will behave as the system pushes them to. They don't have to mitigate and fight against the system that had these roots.
Does that make sense? Well, yeah, it does, but I don't think you can correct certain behavior. I think you're trying to monitor or try to get people to behave a certain way, and I think that's very hard to do. But let's get back to you said 96% of the people you locked up were African-American. Could it be just because you were in a predominantly African-American city? I mean, I live in a predominantly white city, Mike, and I can tell you in the 21 years I've been a cop, the majority of people I've locked up are white people. So
yeah,
is that just the demographics of where you're at, or is it just me?
Different.
No, I'm just asking you. I'm just trying to understand. I mean, I know where you're coming from, but because you've locked up, primarily African American males, does that mean you're racist or the system is racist?
It definitely means the system is racist. Its outcomes are racist, whether we want to know that or not. The city is not 90-some percent black males. It's 40-some percent black males.
Okay.
Right. It's not even that. It's going to be less than that. It's 50-some percent black, so maybe it's 25% black male. So, I mean, that's just and that's where I was. So that's part of the thing is, where do you put policing? Where do these redline communities come from? Where is this history for why the police where they were? Because I only knew the wire of Baltimore. I knew that poor poverty Baltimore. That's where I started from. And that's what I knew from TV and everything else. But I ended up getting an assignment temporarily. And when I was in patrol as a young officer to this area called Mount Washington, which was an elite, mostly white area. And to be there, I couldn't get arrested. Numbers, arrests were there. Like the crimes that took place there took place behind fences. They had property. People aren't walking around. The drugs that were there are in cars that are properly registered and look like everybody else. So you don't actually do anything there. And I still had to get my stats because I was being held to those same measures. So I would go off in the Park Heights into the black neighborhood to get the easy arrests. And that's what you're incentivized to do. The bosses tell you to do these things. And that happens in a lot of places. So where you are, you might not see that. But what I'm trying to tell everybody is that is because you may have had very good leaders and you may have been a good person. But if you were in Baltimore doing the same units that I was doing, you would be doing the same thing I was doing.
Yeah, and again, maybe, and that's why I said, I mean, you were in an area and you had leadership, you know, in your chain of command that was telling you to do this stuff, which is unfortunate. And yeah, like I said, I mean, it's just, but I don't think,
there's a reason why the geography is the way it is. Mm-hmm. So when we look at geographical policing, what we end up saying is that violence is the answer for long-running systemic issues of redlined communities, where they've done things throughout the history to cluster poor and oppressed classes within these certain areas. And then we get to say, oh, no, it's just geographical. Mm-hmm. But we put the people there for that same reason. And then we get to say, oh, no, it's geographical. And it's not.
What do you think about the violence that is happening towards police officers everywhere these days? I mean, you know, and maybe you don't know, I'm sure you do, that inline deaths, officer on duty deaths, are up tremendously from last year. I mean, what do you think about this war on police that is happening right now?
Well, I would say we can only say up tremendously because our numbers are actually so low. It's because we can have a percentage jump, but when you're talking about a huge percentage jump from 42 to 65, well, that looks like a huge percentage jump, but it really can just be statistical noise. So mm-hmm. we don't have enough trend lines yet to make any conclusions what that would mean.
But what do you think? I mean, there's no doubt that hostility, I mean, you've seen the news. I mean, I have, a lot of people have, a lot of listeners have, that hostility towards the police in recent years has risen. I mean, you can't deny that.
It's not hostility towards police. It's towards the way of being policed and police brutality. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, those are very different things is what it is. Like, I mean, I'm with a lot of Black Lives Matter people. I've never heard any of them say that they're anti-police. They're anti-policing and they're anti-police brutality, which are different things. There's a reason why people see policing for what it is. And it's not, that's what I'm trying to say. It's not the police officers. It's because of this system and what it's doing its roots up. So let me explain the three roots of policing, because that's what gets us there. I mean, I think that inevitably the people should rise up against policing because they're being oppressed by a systemically racist and oppressive institution. So it's on us to recognize that and change what policing is, because it's built off of these three issues in American policing, which is unique from anywhere else in the world. And that is because the first policing in America was brought out of the slave patrols in Boston, as most people know, and then those slave patrols ended up capturing runaway slaves, bringing them back to the South and taking them back to the slaveholders, and that started our documentation of what crime was and who we charged. They got a citation for being runaway slaves, and that became the basis of all of our criminal justice data, and that created the first pillar of American policing, which is the creation and maintenance of oppressed classes, and then the extraction of wealth from those classes in order to fund their own oppression. That is the primary mission.
Vincent Peale, Robert Peale, England, we didn't get our modern day policing off the English, which I was always taught in school.
Right. I know that's an illusion. Sir Robert Peale, if you look at his principles, that is not at all policing.
So what takes over? If you want to rise up against police, if you want to rise up against law enforcement in this country, what takes the place?
No, I'm going to argue that we need to change the definition of what policing is, and we need to change its direction by those fundamental issues of realigning those incentives and metrics to go towards what the people
No, but
want.
What you just said was you're aligned with certain groups, and that's fine, but you believe that there should be a revolution and we don't need police officers is basically what I heard from you. So what takes its place?
Not at all. I think we definitely need police officers. I think we don't need police officers to do a lot of the things that we ask them to do. So when we say the job is impossible, it is an impossible job. So stop asking them to do this. We're in a situation where we're asking human beings to do something that they can't do. So we need to restructure the idea of what policing is.
Go ahead.
So we like to have this idea in policing that there's no such thing as a routine car stop, which is preposterous. 99.99999% of car stops, even in the most violent neighborhood, are perfectly routine and completely uneventful. So we get this fear in us to do these things where we have guys with guns who are handling the simple minor traffic violations. So why in the heck do we have people with guns pulling over cars? I think a lot of people would realize that that's probably not a great idea once we think about what we're actually doing and what the statistics are behind it. Meter maids, they write tickets all day long, and they have plenty of potential encounters, but they don't have near the issues that happen because they don't have that interaction of the weapon, and policing is comply or die in America. I don't care whether it's a ticket.
So you're saying that because an officer is strapped, has a gun, that is inciting the potential, I mean, if you have a violator and the officer is doing what they're supposed to be doing, maybe they're pulling over a speeder or maybe they're observing some suspicious activity and they pull over a car or whatever, you're saying the gun itself is inciting that potential violence.
Of course it is. I mean, we know that empirically. Any gun in any presence of any situation makes it inherently more dangerous. Every cop knows this. We just like to blind it out because we say, remember, in every fight that you're in, it is a life and death situation because that gun is there no matter what because yours.
But most officers, you know this, Michael, most officers in their career never discharge their weapon. They never.
Most officers, Patrick, are woefully inept to be carrying that weapon.
I don't know if I agree with that. But
you know,
I
mean, that's, I'm telling you.
That's your opinion. But let me ask you this, Michael. I mean, do you think the majority of officers out there are just good people? They're just trying to do a very difficult. We both agree it's a very difficult job these days to police. It's probably always been a difficult job. Do you think most officers, the majority of officers, are just trying to do a difficult job, and they're good people?
Absolutely. Without question. That's my problem. My whole problem is that we're defending a system that is making us do bad things. And if we would do even what we want to do, then it would be hell of a lot better. This problem is in command and with the structure of a mayor leading police officers. Mm-hmm. This does not work in reality because you have that misalignment. What we fundamentally have to do is we have to align our stakeholders, which is every company out there knows. Exxon uses a stakeholder theory to go ahead and get their customers, maximum benefits for their customers and maximum benefits for their shareholders, and they do it in this ruthless manner that benefits those people. That's something we can do in policing. The problem is even in citizen review boards, when you are judging that officer on a citizen review board, you are judging the punishment only. So you're determining, that's what activists want. Activists want to punish the officer. They want equality in revenge. And that's a fundamentally flawed idea when you are addressing the output. So that officer does something that command told him to do, that the mayor told him to do, that all of his bosses told him to do. And then the moment it goes wrong, you end up having him stand in front of the citizen who didn't determine any of those things that officer did, and then you judge that officer and hang that officer out to dry for being a pawn for those damn commands. That's what I have a problem with.
I want to come back to I should have asked you this earlier, but I want to come back. You know, you saw a lot of crap in your career. You saw a lot of abuses. You saw a lot of officer corruption, I imagine. Did you ever bring this up during your career? And what happened? I mean, what happened? I'm assuming you brought this up. You made it, you know, you went to IA, they had certain.
No, I never went to IA. Come on, man.
So what happened?
So I didn't really understand the puzzle until I was out and could kind of stand back from it a bit.
In 11 years, you were cop for 11 years, you were sergeant, you were supervisor. You never understood the puzzle until you got out.
No, we're not educated to. I mean, I didn't take a really in-depth critical thinking class to the second year of my PhD. I don't think we have an educational system that encourages us to challenge our ideas.
But Michael, you are very obviously a very smart guy. I mean, I can tell you're smart. You're very well spoken. You're very educated. But you mean to tell me in the whole 11 years you were in law enforcement, you never understood what was going on until you got out?
No, I mean, of course I understood. But what I'm telling you is I also understand that when you go to IA, you're done. You're not going to reform anything. One reason why people like to call me a whistleblower, because what I ended up doing, which we could talk about, is I went to Twitter, but I was already out, and I started talking about everything I did. So that's where most people know me. It's coming out on Twitter and starting to name all these things that I had saw, participated in, and said nothing about. But if you do say something, then you end up like Joey Crystal or Serpico or all these other people who don't actually
for those people who don't know who Serpico is, he was a cop in the 70s. He was a NYPD officer. He started blowing the whistle on the massive corruption within the NYPD. They tried to kill him. He survived. He went on. His whole story spawned the Knapp Commission, which, it was a commission that looked at the corruption within NYPD. You mean to tell me in this day and age, it's Serpico within the Baltimore Police Department that you know, it's this Serpico picture you're painting, where if they, that's what they tried to do to Frank Serpico. They tried to kill him.
But we have Joey Crystal. I mean, this was done. So if anybody wants to look up Joe Crystal, who was an officer that worked for me when he was a rookie, when I was a sergeant, and he ended up doing this. He ended up telling everything, going to IA, testifying in court. And you can read all the newspaper stories about his harassment, how he got ran out of the city, got ran out of the state, had to move to Florida, ended up losing, you know, $40,000 a year of his salary for doing absolutely the right thing. Mm-hmm. And there are no whistleblowers who end up making systemic reforms because they're just seen as a rat and a traitor.
You don't have to say anything. I mean, have you ever people out, you know, threatening you? I hope not, but are people threatening you within the department or what?
No. And like, I get that impression a lot from people. But you know, of course in Baltimore, people that knew me, none of them are shocked by anything that I'm saying.
Yeah.
But like, cops and unions aren't the enemy to what I'm saying either. Look, I want a safer world. I do not want cops going in and doing drug raids and risking hurting themselves, being shot because they're at the wrong damn house, throwing a flash grenade in some baby's
Nobody wants that. Nobody wants
right?
that.
We choose that. So we choose that when we choose to fight a drug war on something we know doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the stuff that I'm talking about. I want your officers to come home safely too, but I don't want them to come home safely by being a militarized Orwellian force that decides that violence is the answer. I think we're fundamentally corrupt if we continue to think that violence is the answer. Violence is something that is extremely necessary when the shit hits the fan.
Mm-hmm.
But like, there's people like me. So when we talk about what policing should be, and I don't like to get into that too much because I like to focus more on the structure, and we're probably going to have to do another episode. But what I'm talking about is when you say you don't need policing, like, look, I spent my entire career diving into this. I was a FAST team, an anti-terrorism elite unit in the Marine Corps, where I did all this extreme training and being a firearms weapons. I have the best shooting record in Baltimore police history. And what I'm trying to tell you is yeah, there is a need for people like me that are adrenaline seeking, that want to kick down that door, and they want to go in there with the guns and do everything. Like, I never felt fear on the streets. I felt like if anybody was going to beat me with a damn gun, that was my own fault. I was supposed to be a goddamn pro at this.
Mm.
So I didn't go out there with that fear. I just wanted to go out and have fun, kick ass when I needed to kick ass, but I wanted to be when it had to be at kicking ass. But for God's sake, don't send somebody like me to wonder why your 6-year-old child won't go to school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't send me to your domestic violence issue. Don't send me to a mental health case. Don't send me to do car stops. Like, there are better uses for our time and the risk that we put our officers in and the training that we get them. Because I want a hell of a lot less actual cops. I want policing to be changed to those with guns are only for situations where we need guns. So I want them to be highly trained, highly paid, highly rewarded.
So what do you think, Mike? I mean, I don't know if you heard about this Minneapolis mayoral candidate. I can't remember his name. I think his first name is Raymond. And he came out a couple weeks ago. Heavy, very competitive mayoral race going on. I don't know if you heard this story, but he advocated that, or he believes that cops should not have guns, that they should be locked up, and they should only be taken out in times of emergency. I'm not quoting exactly what he said, but he said that cops, the only thing they should have is I think batons and pepper spray.
Well, I mean, fundamentally, here's my ultimate objection to any of those opinions.
Mm-hmm.
We're in an environment where we need to listen to our stakeholders and our customers, essentially the people, on what the outcomes they want. The big problem is because you know what outcomes you want, doesn't mean you understand how to get them. That's for a different avenue of professionals who understand policing and understand systems and institutions and how they work. So I understand him saying that those are goals that he would like to achieve. And those are goals I would like to achieve with some realistic measures in place. Mm-hmm. For one, I took off a baton the day I used it the first time. And I never wore it again, even though it was departmental policy, mm-hmm. because it was a white guy who robbed a store, a CVS, and got into a foot chase with us. He was armed, and we ended up getting into a fight with him. And all I had was my baton out. So, you know, the weapon that's in your hand is what you're left with.
Mm-hmm.
And he was coked up, and I ended up beating the crap out of this guy. I mean, the ambulance had the tubes going down his nose, sucking everything out, and, like, mm-hmm. people were around videotaping it and everything. But we were completely in the right, but there was just no way that I could justify the visual of me with that baton in my hand. I was like, no way, that's not something we do. So no, they shouldn't have batons. That's preposterous.
No. But he said
him to say that. Like, so that's one reason why I pointed out is that he's saying that that just gives you an idea of not actually being on the street and knowing how.
Oh yeah, is. Yeah, and that's my point.
He says no gun, when he says the cops shouldn't have guns, so I want to redefine policing. I want people to be handling things that aren't cops. But the actual cops, abolishment is a goal. We want to set up incentives so that we can have as few many armed people that are state-sanctioned agents as possible. But I cannot envision a future where abolishment is a reality.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to get your, because a while ago when we were talking, you said that, you know, we were given the example of a traffic stop, that mere gun, view of a gun, officer strapped, has that he or she has that gun on their hip, that's going to incite violence. And I guess my point is that you just said, well, we need guns with officers. I mean, the qualified officers, and hopefully, I mean, I'm just naive, but I like to think the majority of people out there are a few idiot officers. We both know that, at least in my opinion. I don't think it's all these officers. But if you just said that gun incites violence, and so.
I think that gun, the presence of that gun is violence, Patrick. Mm-hmm. That's what I think. I think that's fundamentally violence. Its mere presence mm-hmm. enhances the risk at all times. So it is violence. It is violence as the answer. And so there are certain situations where violence is not the answer. We should only
I agree.
Things for violence is the answer.
I agree. I mean,
hopefully do everything we can to make sure that violence stops being the answer.
Oh, I agree. I agree with 100%. Look, I don't think any cop out there, and maybe I'm just naive, Mike, and I don't know what your take is. I don't think any cop out there, you were in a much rougher area than I am. I am right now. And working, but I mean, I don't think any cop wakes up in the morning, kisses their wife goodbye or kids, and says, "You know, I'm going to go shoot somebody today. I'm going to go get into."
No, there's certainly some.
Well, I mean, yeah, I'm not. That's why I'm saying I'm sure that there's some idiots out there, and if they think that way out there, get the hell out of the profession. Get rid of them.
Yeah, Let me throw. Let me throw you the last thing before we end up having to go into a separate episode. I don't think that there's that many human beings that are capable of handling this weapon when the shit really hits the fan. That's what we see when we see issues like Terrence McCrutcher being killed, when we see Philando Castile and Tamir Rice being killed. I fundamentally think that we think there's training that teaches people how to use a weapon in an environment where the stress just came out of nowhere and you're in a life or death situation. What I don't think that you can train that. When we are in special forces and you get guys that are in force recon, that are in fast teams, that are in SEALs, we go through these levels of qualifications where we end up thinking what we're doing is we're training SEALs and force recon and Marines to be these well-trained shooters who can respond under pressure. But what I fundamentally think we're actually doing is we are selecting people who don't have a genetic response to fear and stress, and that's an extremely small amount of people.
Yeah, but Mike, I was in the 82nd. I was in the Army. I have some of the same training you did. We're different, you know. I mean, you're trained. You were an elite unit in the Marine Corps. I was in. You know, I jumped out of planes with the 82nd Airborne down at Bragg. You know, not everybody is going to be cut from the same cloth. I do think, though, you can train the fundamentals, and people can become good marksmen with weapons. Can they become like you or other people, spec op guys? Probably not, because they're not, you know, they're not on the range every day.
Can they become shooters when the rounds are coming at
that,
them?
That's my point. You give me, you know this, Mike. You get into some stressful situations, you get into some duress, you know, you get the best shooters in the world and you get them in there, and where are they going to land the rounds? They're probably going to be better than the average Joe. You get people on a range in a static situation where there's no pressure, and you've seen it on the range when you were a cop. I mean, some of these people, their rounds are everywhere. Yes.
That's even just the decision to pull a trigger, Patrick. I don't think they have the decision to make sound decisions within whether to pull the trigger or not.
Mm-hmm. But how many...
like, when you look at Terrence McCutcher being killed, I believe her. I think she was in fear of her life, but that was an absolutely irrational fear.
Was it that guy who was in... he went back to his van, he was reaching into the van?
Yeah, okay. Well, he wasn't reaching in. The windows were rolled.
I remember that. Okay.
So there was no reason, there's no textbook that of best practices or training that would ever say you pull a trigger in that situation. Mm-hmm. And I think that she gets all, no matter how much training you give her, she does not have the DNA, or whether it's hormones or whether it's a flooding the system. It's not a male-female thing. I think people have a genetic predisposition to be able to, their body doesn't have a fight or flight. And those people are the ones who respond properly under stress.
So there's about 850, maybe 900,000 local police officers in this country. Don't quote me on a number, but I think that's kind of, so that includes municipal agencies, doesn't include federal agencies. So you mean to tell me the majority of those people are inept? They can't fire a weapon.
Yeah, totally. And I think that they will not pass the mere basics. I think the entire world would be shocked by how bad they are at shooting. And I think if they were ever in a real situation where the stress levels were up, they would be so bad, you would be afraid of your life. And that's one reason why we don't study these things. That's why this data is not transparent. That's why we hide all this stuff, because if when we start talking about reality of what it is we're going to open up a lot of doors people don't want to go down.
Well, Michael Wood, I really appreciate you coming on the show, and you bring a different perspective on the issues that we face in criminal justice. I appreciate you coming on, sir, and I want to welcome you again back on, because next time I want to talk about, we're kind of scratching the surface of some other issues that I want to talk about. I want to get into civilian-led policing the next time you come on, if you're cool with that.
Yeah, absolutely. So if people want to check that out, civilianledpolicing.org, and then we can have some little bit more questions. That's my solution method. We still have a lot to discuss to get there, yeah. And this could probably go on for forever. I would love...
I want to bring you back on, Mike. And once again, man, thank you for your service to the Marine Corps and service to the Baltimore Police Department. How can people find you? I know you mentioned civilianledpolicing.org. Where else can they find you, buddy?
I'm on Twitter a lot, but be ready for me to be brash and aggressive, or just go to the website, michaelawoodjr.net.
Well, I appreciate it, Mike. Take care, man. Be safe.
Thank you, brother.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast, and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.